Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries plus napkins plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
In evolution, you only have to be good enough. This on? Hello?
We're all science people.
Science!
Exactly.
We know it's a good idea because it's lasted.
We can teach kids and they get it.
There's chemistry in here. There's biology in here.
It's in whiskey. It's in ice cream. It's in who you fall in love with.
That's the recipe for success.
We can make the world better for everybody.
Starting now.
Welcome, welcome to Science Rules. I'm your host, Bill Nye. This is the show where science rules. It's a call-in show, so if you want to be on the show, and I hope you do, the number to dial is 470-ASK-BILL. That's 470-275-2455. Ask Bill, 470-275-2455. You can keep up with me on the electric internet to find out when to call. As always, you can also send us your questions and comments at askbillnye.com. And once again, I am joined, of course, by science writer, editor, dear friend, Corey S. Powell. Greetings, Corey.
Greetings, Bill Nye. It's so good to be here. And, you know, Bill, remind me, what's your favorite thing? I mean, your favorite thing in the world besides Bill Nye?
I think I know what you're driving at. It's evolution.
Yes. That's the thing.
The fact of life. Evolution explains why we're here. And along this line, Corey, today, we are joined by an expert in genetics and evolution, Dr. Molly Przeworski. Welcome to Science Rules, Dr. Przeworski. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Now, Molly, I'm sure our listeners are completely familiar with evolutionary population genetics, but can you just explain, population genetics?
Just in case anybody listening is not familiar with population genetics, maybe you could tell us a little bit about. Just in case.
So population genetics is the study of genetic differences, of heritable differences among individuals and across species.
What's the difference between population genetics and genetics?
So we're interested in the processes as they play out in populations. We want to understand genetics is about sort of transmission within families and those rules. We're interested in how those processes play out in populations to bring about adaptations, to bring about new species over generations and generations.
Well, now this is interesting. How do you model it?
Right. So the thing that's interesting about population genetics is that the field is interested in things like questions about why some people are taller than others, what the genetic differences that contribute to differences in height, and why people feel differently about, say, cilantro. Some people find it soapy. Some people find it delicious. And these kinds of questions, people have asked them long before we had any data. And when they started thinking about them, they sort of thought about them from first principles. They thought, well, how could that come about? There must be mutations. These mutations must get transmitted. They must become more or less common over time. And so just from first principles, they built these mathematical models that describe these processes. And now, a century after they started asking these questions, we have a ton of data and we can start to actually test the extent to which these models were accurate.
Well, what you want in any theory, if I understand this, is to be able to predict, right?
Right.
So have you predicted something that's come true?
Yeah, it's actually kind of amazing how well these thought experiments have turned out to guide kind of our data analysis today. So, for example, there's theory that super old now, about 80 years old, about why there are disease alleles in human populations. Why are there disease alleles? Why don't they just disappear?
Let's pause
for a second. Corey, if you're like me, you have so often asked, why are there disease alleles?
I do frequently ask
that. If only I was clear on what a disease allele is, was.
I think we need to define what an allele is.
Sure, yeah. Sorry. I don't mean that. I should say actually disease.
No, don't be sorry. Molly, bring it on. Go wild.
We love learning new things. That's why we're here.
Right. So the question is, why are there mutations in human populations that cause disease?
So alleles are just variations on a,
okay,
on a gene.
Okay. So when you say disease, you're not talking about infectious disease. You're talking about some a syndrome, a condition
that's
undesirable.
Right. Yeah. So some diseases, most diseases, have some genetic component to them, and we want to and those mutations that contribute to those diseases are at some.
What's an example? Alzheimer's disease. What's an example?
Tay-Sachs, mutations that cause Tay-Sachs are an example of a really severe.
What are the symptoms of Tay-Sachs?
So this is a horrible disease that manifests itself really early in life, and if you inherit two copies of this disease mutation, then you develop this disease and invariably die in the first years of life. So that's just an example of a really severe disease mutation.
So the old saying in evolution, and we're not changing the subject, we're talking about disease alleles, as anybody would on the show. In evolution, you only have to be good enough. So if there is a mutation that kills you, that would get weeded out pretty quickly, and weeded out, I guess, is a pun. That would get eliminated pretty quickly, right?
Right. So then the question is, well, why are they still there? And a long time ago when people started thinking about this, so in the 30s, they hypothesized that they're there because even though they do decrease in frequency for the reasons you say, because people who have them don't leave children, they also get reintroduced by new mutations. And that creates this balance where they're being eliminated from the population but also introduced into the population. And so people develop models for that, and we can go ahead and test now, does that explain the frequency of Tay-Sachs? And it turns out it's a pretty good explanation for how
in
common
other words,
Tay-Sachs is.
If a kid, a baby, had had Tay-Sachs in 1719 and that baby didn't reproduce, that kid didn't grow up— but then would it be the same Tay-Sachs that you'd get in 2019 that's reintroduced or a different form?
Pretty much the same disease, but not necessarily caused by the exact same change in the genome. So there's probably hundreds of places in the genome where a mutation could cause Tay-Sachs. So one of those reoccurred, basically.
And these mutations, these are just completely random, basically errors in the DNA caused by radiation, by transcription errors when your DNA is reproducing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right, that's exactly right. So you're basically, in order to reproduce, you have to retype out the whole genome, all 3 billion letters of it twice, and there are typos. And these typos are totally accidental, and they underlie these disease mutations. But amazingly, they also underlie, ultimately, all the adaptations we see. So when we look around us, all the biodiversity, all the intricate adaptations we can think of, at the end of the day, they have as their source these typos. But
how
again,
do we repair damaged DNA?
So there's this whole machinery in the cell that basically constantly scans the genome when it's being copied. And checks. It's basically like an error-proofing mechanism, exactly like you might have autocorrect, and autocorrect doesn't get things right all the time, as we all know.
So, an expression you hear all the time, you're talking about diseases. Infectious diseases are something you're susceptible to or you're not based on your inventory or library of antibodies, right? But whether or not you can generate antibodies successfully must have something to do with what you've inherited.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Is there a way to manipulate genes so that we can anticipate infections coming at us and deal with them in advance?
Right. So the easier part is actually the manipulating of the genetics. The harder part is understanding what effects that will have. So we can increasingly manipulate the genome, but what we don't know is if it's good for a particular disease, it might also be bad for susceptibility to other diseases. If it's good in this environment, might it also be really bad in some other environment?
There are a lot of people out there. How do you get enough genetic information to figure out what these genes are doing, what's getting, you know, upselected or downselected.
Right. So we have an increasing number of genome sequences from humans, hundreds of thousands, millions now of whole genomes that we can
when
study.
You say from, we have. Yeah. I mean, you've recorded or published.
From where? Where do they come from?
So the research community has access to them because they've been generated for biomedical studies mostly. So people's genomes have been sequenced, for example, in studies trying to associate genetic variants with coronary artery disease or for those kinds of goals. But what's really interesting is that even though we sort of think of ourselves as having relatives like our family and then being unrelated to other humans, in fact, all humans are related. And we're related by this huge pedigree that traces back thousands of years. And so actually by studying some humans, we kind of get a window into studying all of humanity because of this interconnectedness. So we don't have to sequence all 7 billion people on the planet to have a really good idea of how humans evolved generally.
But along this line, I often... Now, who are my best friends, really, Corey?
I would say primates of some sort.
Well,
but I'm
dogs.
Not...
Let's say dogs.
Oh, so I clearly was off base with primates. Let's go with that.
A little bit.
Yeah.
So people are fascinated with what breed of dog they're dealing with, what combination, what mix. They got extraordinary names. They got extraordinary contractions to describe the combination. But they're all dogs. And the same is true of humans, yes? I mean, I say all the time, if an Australian interacts with a Norwegian or an Aboriginal person in a continent of Australia interacts with somebody from Scandinavia, all you're going to get is a human. You're not going to get some new thing.
Right.
So do you have a larger message this way? Like, hey, everybody, we're all related kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the coolest results that comes out of actually not so much population genetics and also some computer science work is that you don't have to go back very far before we all actually have the same family tree. And what I mean by that is if you think about it—
How far is not very far?
Tens of thousands of years.
That's nothing,
Corey. From the perspective of evolution, that's nothing, right? I mean, if we think about the fact that we probably had a common ancestor with chimps 10 million years ago, it's a tiny sliver of that time before everybody on the planet has the same family tree. And that's, I mean, I actually find that really counterintuitive somehow and hard to come to grips with, but it's fascinating because, you know, we're also interested in who our grandparents were and great-grandparents and so forth. But if you go back not that many generations, then the answer is the same for everyone. And that's kind of strange.
Kind of strange. So,
and it's kind of cool.
We
really are a human family.
So, but with that said.
We have callers.
We have callers.
We have Nathan on the line.
Nathan.
Yes, hello. How are you?
Where are you calling from?
I'm located in Southwest Virginia in a city called Roanoke.
Roanoke's a venerable Virginia crossroads, the many railroads there in the beautiful Piedmont of the Appalachians.
Yes, sir.
Yes, gorgeous area. Take it. What's your question, Nathan?
My question is, if one day we are to colonize Mars, could our genes eventually evolve and adapt to live on the planet, or would we have to rely on some kind of genetic engineering prior to moving there?
Well, that's simple enough. So, Nathan, let me just start by saying we discourage nowadays in the modern astrobiological world, we discourage the use of the term colonize. Instead, let us favor settle. When we settle Mars.
Or populate, maybe.
Populate. Do we need to do genetic changes in advance, Dr. Molly?
Yeah, so we don't know. I guess we could. We could have variation among us that would enable us to adapt to some features of life on Mars. Or it may be that life on Mars, in many regards we know it is so different from anything that any mutations that we already carry would enable us to respond to that no, we would all die out before we'd have a chance to adapt.
Nathan, the other thing you'll pick up right away is there's no air on Mars. That would be
slightly problematic.
Catch your attention for a few moments before you...
Right.
I think you're definitely going to want a space suit for starters because I don't think you're going to be able to evolve that one fast enough. Mm.
But that is a cool question.
Right, right.
Why do you have an interest in settling, populating Mars?
Well, I've followed you for quite some time, Bill, and I sense here on Earth there's a lot of climate change. along with a lot of new innovative stuff like SpaceX, and along with NASA programs, I see a more foreseeable future with that. So based off of this episode and around the title of it, I wanted to see if that was something, you know, that we could possibly get to in time, or if, you know, I've even heard as far as the terraforming, like dome cities. I mean, as you know, I know that's a little bit of like a fairy tale situation, but just kind of wanted to get all of y'all's two cents on it.
Well, I'll say this, though, in an unrelated but related note, I'm pretty sure we're going to have to aggressively genetically modify crops in order to feed everybody in the next 30 years. And so maybe if you really want to go try living on Mars, maybe the technology for crops modification will enable you to not die as fast as you would otherwise.
So
thank you, Nathan.
So Nathan, I want to thank you so much for the question and for making us think about how humans will be evolving on Mars now that we're starting to understand how humans are evolving on Earth.
Carry on.
Thank you. Thank you, guys.
All right. Pieta, is that how I said? Pieta, Pieta, are you out there?
Hello, Bill. Hello, Corey. Hello, Molly.
Hello.
Hello.
My question is, I'm from originally Iceland.
Okay.
And there the people of Iceland often practice abortion on the intellectually disabled. Down syndrome, mm-hmm, or
sort of thing,
something
right.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is, could this have unforeseen consequences on other genetic factors?
Pieta, are you concerned that there will be less intellectual disability in the future? Because we have no shortage of intellectual disability.
I think the question here, tell me if I'm getting this correctly. Are you worried that if you're weeding out one specific trait, you're weeding out Down syndrome or some other mental disabilities, that you might be weeding out other things along the way inadvertently? Is that what you're asking?
Yes, exactly. I myself have a mental retardation, and so I worry about this. I think about this. I was lucky enough. My parents did not have me aborted, but many others are, and I think it could have unforeseen consequences.
It's a great question. Molly, what do you think?
Right. So this is discussed a lot, unfortunately, increasingly in the context of potential embryo selection. And so there's a lot of discussion in many directions. But one of the directions is, do we really understand that when we select someone who we think might do better at school, we're not selecting for all kinds of other traits that we might not want to be selecting for? And the truth is, we don't know yet. It's a really hard question.
Stick around for more Science Rules after this.
Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries plus napkins plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Science Rules is back.
Well, here, let me ask the big question. Humans are still evolving in some way. Does your research tell you how we're evolving or what we're evolving into?
So humans are still evolving, definitely. That doesn't mean necessarily the exciting thing that people think it means, because evolving doesn't necessarily mean adapting. So evolving just means that genetic changes are occurring, that some things are becoming less common and some things are becoming more common. Curly hair maybe is becoming more common, hypothetically. I have no idea. So we are evolving, definitely. I think what people are really interested in, including myself, is, are we still adapting? Are there still ways in which we're sort of becoming better able to have offspring or survive in our environment for genetic reasons?
Well, is there a large enough fraction of the population that has access to the extraordinary technology that would enable selection of embryos for intellect? Is that a very big fraction?
Well, now it's obviously quite small. Well, now it's a vanishingly small fraction. But over time, who knows? And I think that's why people are starting to ask those questions now.
It's like in vitro fertilization used to be rare.
Right, now, exactly.
In the developed world.
Right.
Yeah. Do you have any predictions about humans of the future?
None whatsoever.
Really?
Yeah.
You don't predict
we're
that
we're going to spend a lot of time on iPhones.
That's a pretty safe prediction. Well, okay, let me try to bring it a little more near term. Can you actually see adaptations emerging? Is there anything that you can see happening right now?
Yes, but on incredibly short timescales. So I wouldn't say adaptations emerging. We can identify genetic differences that lead individuals to live longer or shorter. These are minute differences.
So like, what would be an example of that?
Well, so we showed, for example, and other people have found this as well, that people that carry mutations that lead them to smoke more, if they smoke, tend to have a somewhat shorter lifespan. It's not surprising, because if you smoke more, you're more likely to get cancer, and that shortens your lifespan. It's obviously a small effect, but we can detect it. Of course, that's, again, something that's environmentally contingent, because if people didn't smoke, then that would not be a selective pressure.
Okay. Oh, we have another caller here I'd love to bring into the mix. We have Stephanie on the line.
Stephanie, where are you calling from?
Hey, guys. I'm calling from Austin, Texas. How are y'all doing?
We are good. How are you?
Keep it weird.
That's right. Keep it weird. Doing good, yeah. So my question is there a correlation between affluence and genetics disease risk?
Between affluence and your genetic disease risk?
So the richer your family,
yes.
Are you more prone or less prone to get genetic diseases?
So there are diseases that are different frequencies, for example, in different parts of the world. And some of those diseases, it's by chance, and some of those diseases is actually because it's tied to the evolutionary history of that particular part of the world. So, for example, sickle cell anemia is a kind of famous example of a disease that is at higher frequency in places where there's malaria, mm-hmm. because you get sickle cell when you have two copies of the sickle cell allele, the sickle cell variant. But if you have only one copy, then you're actually partially resistant to malaria. And so that keeps that disease allele in the population where there's a lot of malaria, but not elsewhere. So that's one example. And there are other examples like that of diseases that vary geographically. And then because some groups have colonized others and so forth, that leads to differences in the prevalence of diseases across different groups, sometimes by chance and sometimes because of these different ancestry histories.
So, Stephanie, did that answer your question? If you're wealthy, don't marry necessarily within other wealthy small family.
Don't marry your brother or sister
because that person's also wealthy. Yeah.
Well, I'm married, and I'm pretty sure he's not my brother, so I think we're good.
Okay. We're very glad to hear
you
it
you are
over here.
Related. You're part of the human family. Don't kid yourself the way people do.
Follow up question to that. So I've heard it said that breast cancer is a deep disease of affluence, or, you know, it disproportionately affects affluent families. What do you have any insight on that? And
so what is true is that people who are not at all affluent suffer from a whole slew of other diseases, in particular infectious diseases, that are not much of an issue in much wealthier settings or countries. And so kind of the types of diseases that affluent people have to worry about are different than the types of diseases that not affluent people have to worry about, but mainly because they're avoiding a whole slew of other diseases.
Now, what about living longer? Do affluent people live longer, so they live long
enough
affluent, to get cancer?
Right. Yeah. In this, that's similarly, because they live longer, they might worry more about cardiovascular disease and cancer rather than things that happen.
Mm-hmm. Stephanie, thank you for this call. Carry on and keep Austin weird to the extent that it should be.
we have another caller on the line.
Sean, are you out there?
Yes.
Sean, where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Longview, Washington.
Yes. I was just going across the bridge a few weeks ago at Mount St. Helens. So, Sean.
Excellent.
What's your question?
Well, I've got quite a unique situation to pose for you guys. I am a de novo mutation of neurofibromatosis type 1, and I happen to have the genetic conditions of celiacs and dermatitis herpetiformis. I passed these on to my son.
Celiacs, in the last, I think we know celiacs is an allergy to wheat.
Well, it's a genetic intolerance to gluten. And yeah, for most people, it's not anaphylactic, but for me, it is. The question is, what direction is genetics going in order to assist people with just their daily lives in dealing with these types of conditions, being able to test and know that you should be testing everybody for a series of genetic markers, like celiac disease, because that's a disease that's now recognized as being non-symptomatic. You don't have digestive problems, but you'll have health issues tied to it if you were to be able to diagnose that as a routine.
You mean to be able to diagnose it, or to be able to kind of predict who will get it?
To identify a list of normal, a list of genetic conditions that every time somebody's tested for their genome, those markers are automatically looked for, just to be able to provide them with some basic health care.
I think that is definitely a direction that human genetics is moving towards. I think one of the big goals of collecting these much larger data sets of genetic variation data and coupling them with electronic health records is to identify more cases of any specific disease and every specific combination of disease and learn more about those patients so that the patients can be can know what happened to other patients with similar profiles and so forth. So I actually think that this kind of thing is again, slightly removed from what I do, but I interact enough with human geneticists who have that as their central goal, actually, developing these kinds of resources and giving doctors and clinicians the ability to look into unified data sets to find other people with similar genetic profiles and be able to better inform their patients.
Thanks for the call, Sean.
Thank you.
Science Rules will be right back.
Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries plus napkins plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.
You're listening to Science Rules.
Now, Molly, if I understand correctly, you are working on the Alzheimer's gene, APOE4, that this is a gene you've studied of sort of how it's moving around through human populations. This is true?
So what we did is we were interested in trying to find mutations that seem to influence lifespan of their carriers. And that's the study in which we found also that these mutations in receptors that influence how much where nicotine binds, that influence how much you smoke if you smoke, influence lifespan. So we also found, and other people had found this as well, that carriers of a particular mutation in APOE4, which is associated with Alzheimer's.
This is a gene.
This is a gene.
Which we whimsically call what, AP?
Well, I don't, but it has been whimsically called, as you say, APOE. And the particular variant, the particular mutation is called APOE4. And it's been associated by my group and others with a shorter lifespan. This manifests itself only in its 70s. It's not a big effect, but we can start to detect its effect. And we don't know whether it's really associated with Alzheimer's or associated with things that co-occur with Alzheimer's, like cardiovascular disease. It's not a massive effect, but we were interested in looking at this kind of thing, at mutations that affect survival and affect the number of kids that people have.
Okay, so this is another one where I'm wondering, Alzheimer's is typically a disease that sets in late in life after you've already had kids. So does it ever get weeded out? Is it just, are we stuck with it forever? Is that just part of who we are?
I think it's not so clear cut. So naively, you might think, and this is what I first thought, that exactly as you say, because it manifests itself so late in life, maybe it just doesn't matter and it's basically neutral with regard to. But first of all, men do reproduce throughout their lifespan. And in fact, one in a couple thousand offspring is born to fathers who are actually quite old and so wouldn't be born otherwise. And then also, there are all these hypotheses about the kind of sticking around to take care of your kids and grandparents sticking around to take care of their kids and the importance that that might have. So these things, these kind of ideas of inclusive
drag
fitness.
People down. It takes resources
right.
to deal with an Alzheimer's right. patient parent.
It could be that, or it could be the other way around, that if you, you know, the other, namely, if you don't have Alzheimer's, then you're able to
you be, can a, be a nurturing grandparent.
Yeah,
you can
exactly.
help your survival.
And your child can have more offspring as a result. And so those things have to be considered, too, in thinking about how many descendants a mutation has.
Now, Alice. Alice, are you out there?
Hi there. Hi, everyone. I'm from San Francisco.
San Francisco, Wonderland, if you will. So you have a question.
Yes. My question is about where the world is going in terms of what the world looks like. So I've been told that ultimately the world will look a lot like Brazil, where you have a lot of increase in interracial couples and ultimately, everyone will kind of blend together. And I'm curious to hear your perspectives on this and also when you think something like that would happen.
So, Alice, you're talking about facial features and skin color.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, because I think it's interesting, right? This whole concept of diversity of genes and in different populations, you know, coming together theoretically makes the gene pool better. I mean, from what I've learned, at least in science class, tell me if that's wrong. But, curious to get your perspectives on what that looks like and how quickly something like that could happen.
Right. Actually, because there's mutations constantly being introduced every generation, it's not the case that everything is kind of going to blend into the same thing because there'll always be a source of variation as well as this source of mixing.
So we're not going to all be super fit Brazilian guys. Corey and I, that look fabulous.
Are you sure? Is there any way that we could
be? I'm hesitantly saying this, but no.
Yeah,
you will
okay.
not.
All right. I'll just make do with what I got.
So we have this idea that it's just since travel and since transatlantic travel in particular that there's this mixing has occurred, but actually we're learning that no, ever since actually humans and Neanderthals are a nice example, right? Those are really divergent groups. And now we know that humans and Neanderthals interbred and had offspring.
They learned to love each other.
Well, maybe they didn't even learn. Maybe it came very quickly. And so it isn't a kind of particularity of our time. And in particular, Europe, which has been studied a lot because so many of our fossil remains from which ancient DNA has been recovered are in Europe, you know, we see that what we think of as, quote unquote, a European population is actually a bunch of quite diverged populations coming together over the past 10,000 years. And so that's a recurrent theme. And again, it's much more of a social and historical set of events than it really is a kind of clear evolutionary dynamic.
But there's something logical to what Alice is asking, that if everybody's mixing, if this tendency to mix or this drive to mix is universal, then we might converge on a universal design, skin color and face feature. But I think it's going to be a few weeks or millennia because novelty is always valued. And if you don't believe me, the Beach Boys have a minor hit, The New Girl in School. So she's novel and therefore of interest. So novelty is, in some cases, has a selection advantage.
Bill, I think for our younger listeners, we might need to explain. The Beach Boys were a pop vocal group.
They were all males.
Yes.
They were actually part of California, grown men during
most of their career.
And their harmonies featured not only hitting the same note, but as the saying goes, the same part of the note. We digress, but that is an example of genetic similarity creating a specific musical sound. Alice, that is actually a heck of a question, a fantastic question. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Corey.
Bill, it's lightning time. I can feel it. I don't
yes.
know. Sometimes I just... It's like the hairs on the back of my neck are standing up.
It's probably not from an electromagnetic effect. It's just it's time for the lightning round.
It's being so close to you, Bill.
Sure it is. So, Molly, doctor, it's time for the lightning round. We ask you a question. You give an answer that's pretty quick. If you could delete any part of your genome, Molly, what would it be?
I would probably add a slight appetite suppressant.
Appetite suppressant. yes. All right. If do you have a favorite genetic mutation? Not just a favorite gene, a favorite mutation.
Yeah. I'm pretty fond of red hair, so I'm going to go for red hair.
The ginger. You're going to preserve it. Yeah, way to go.
Somebody's got to look out for the gingers.
Now, and then what do you want to know next? What's your next thing? We've preserved the red hair. You got that's done.
I want to know if corals are going to make it. That's what I really want to know.
So do you want to preserve, do you want to do work that preserves corals?
Well, and yeah, if I could, I would really like to do that, yeah.
So, are you finding corals that are more resistant?
So people
give us hope.
This is new for me. I've only been working on this for 18 months, and people know lots about this that I don't know. But yeah, there does seem to be variation in how resilient they are, and it would be really good if some of them made it, if enough of them made it.
Why do you want to preserve corals?
Because, well, first, they're beautiful, and also, you know, some huge fraction of fish, a quarter of the ocean's biomass depends on them. So
on that forest, that underwater forest bastion of diversity. So with that said, this has been a cool discussion. I very much appreciate you taking the time to come in here. I am Bill Nye.
I am Corey S. Powell.
And remember, when it comes to the genetic evolutionary part of our universe,
science rules.
So if you like Science Rules, please take a moment to rate and review it in Apple Podcasts and on Stitcher. It helps us out and helps other people learn about the show. So thank you. Be sure to follow me on the Electric Internet for information about when to call into the show. I'm at Bill Nye on everything, the gram, the Twitter thing, the facing of books. And meanwhile, if you'd like to leave us a voicemail, you remember that technology, give us a call at 201-472-0785. That's 201-472-0785. Leave us a voicemail. Our guest today has been Dr. Molly Przeworski. I got a shrug. Thank you for coming in, Molly. It was just cool. You are studying us. You're learning more about humans and our place in the universe. How cool is that? And I very much hope you and your lab mates can preserve corals for the world. Science Rules is produced by Jordan Bell and Corey S. Powell, shown here, with extra production from Lisa Wang and Ashley Warren, who are also our call screeners. So when you call in, they have a listen. Our engineer today is Jared O'Connell. Mixing and original theme music are by Casey Halford. Special thanks, of course, to Claire Rawlinson and Ashley Warren. Chris Bannon is the CCO, the Chief Content Officer here at Stitcher. And at Stitcher, science rules.
Stitcher.
Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries, plus napkins, plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this, plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, Essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.